afternoon, everybody, and happy new year to you all. Yeah, we've got the new year, what, 3 days old now? And we're happy to have you on board for a new year here, a whole new year of new shows for you. Good afternoon, Stan Turner here. Thank you for your company. It's 12:06. You heard the man. We're at 28 degrees. Enjoy it while you might, because we're going to the deep freeze here tonight. And speaking of the new year, I always like to, Kyle, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you doing?
I am very well.
I have a saying I like to use on the new year. May your troubles this year, this new year, last only as long as your New Year's resolutions, huh? That makes some sense to me, huh?
Yeah.
Most of our resolutions go right overboard within a day or two, don't they, huh?
Mine are still holding strong.
Are they?
But
let's talk about it next week
Yeah, really.
Well, here we are. Yes, Kyle's our board up here and producer. We are raring to go here in this new year. You know, some years ago, I covered politics and government for KSTP TV Channel 5. And that, of course, included covering the state legislature. Some folks almost looked on me with pity, asking, isn't that awfully boring, covering the legislature? You know, those people sitting around committee tables, droning on day after day, week after week, month after month. How did you stay awake, they asked me. Well, the answer is that despite appearances and, oratory and debate that sometimes seem to go nowhere, the lawmaking process is where the action is. Everything our lawmakers do has an impact, sometimes a profound impact, on our lives. And like all government and political institutions, we need to pay close attention to what's going on, because ultimately it is about us. So here we are on the cusp of a new legislature and a new Congress, and lots of hot potatoes are on the plate, political hot potatoes. This noon, we will look at what lawmakers have done in the recent past and what they will be up to in just a few days. It's helpful, of course, to have an expert guide to help us news types and citizens navigate through this government and political thicket. And we have such an expert with us today. Undoubtedly, many of you have seen, heard, and read his readings or soundings on the body politics. Stephen Scheer is a professor of political science at Carleton College in Northfield, just south of the Twin Cities. His words of wisdom are found in such places as the New York Times, Washington Monthly, Brookings Review, BBC, and he blogs on American politics for the Atlantic Monthly, and you see and hear him on local broadcast outlets. So here we are, and here we go. Good afternoon, Professor Scheer, and Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy New Year, Stan.
Thank you. Very nice of you to take time to be with us today. You know, this time of year, Steve, you'd be in Washington, wouldn't you, with some of your students?
Well, I have run the Washington program 12 times, and usually in the winter, and I think tomorrow's weather will indicate why we went to Washington in the winter.
Well, you created this program. It's called Carleton in Washington, and what a wonderful way for students to get a up-close and personal look at the process, huh?
Right, and it was also good for me as a teacher, because I was able to stay current and understand how Washington really works, and that's been of great value in the classroom.
How Washington really works. Maybe we'll delve into that today. I don't know if there are any answers to that or not, but yeah. We'll certainly touch upon that along the way. You are a Sherlockian. You love Sherlock Holmes, don't you?
I do, and I use Sherlock's techniques in studying politics, because there are all sorts of quotes from Sherlock that are very useful in studying the social and political world. And as he says, it's of vital importance in the art of detection to determine which facts are incidental and which ones are vital.
Uh-huh.
And that's my job.
It is, and you do your job well, sir. There's another quote you and I like. I think this is from A Scandal in Bohemia.
The first story.
Yep. Sherlock talking to Dr. Watson, and he addresses Watson saying, "You see, but you do not observe. The distinction is clear. You see, but you do not observe." How do we apply that one to government and politics?
Yeah. Well, I think most people don't pay careful attention to what's going on. You know, they're
correct.
Not actively seeking political information. And if you're actively seeking information, you're observing and concluding things from the information you receive. But a lot of people don't bother to make that effort. And so they're seeing things without really processing them. And that's what Sherlock is talking about.
And I think a lot of people would say that's what's wrong with our society these days. We'll talk more about the American public's political IQ as we go along here. But first, Steve Scheer, if you wouldn't mind, let's just look back at 2014, both in the state of Minnesota and the nation at large, politically and governmentally. In Minnesota here, what about major political and government developments last year? What are the one or two that really stand out?
Well, I would say the major event were the 2014 elections, which somewhat changed the direction of state politics with the Republican control of the state House, which will really impede the Democratic agenda and Governor Dayton's agenda going forward. So that sort of stands out to me as the big event of the year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we saw that Governor Dayton and Al Franken, two Democrats, won handily this time around. Landslide, Al Franken barely made it through last time. This time he had a pretty good margin, as did Dayton. And all the DFL constitutional officers got reelected without any problem. But as you say, things went against the Democrats in the House. The Republicans took back a lot of those seats, especially in outstate Minnesota, where Democrats had what we might call a tenuous hold on that over the last couple of years.
So, right.
Yeah.
Right. Only one of the seat gains by the Republicans in the state House was in the metro area. That was in Burnsville. All the rest were in greater Minnesota.
So, Steve, was the last election, was it in fact as popularly held a mandate on Barack Obama, even here in Minnesota? Or did voters just go their own way?
Well, I think that events conspired to make it a very good night for Republicans. If you look nationally, the Republicans are in a historically strong position. They hold more seats in state legislatures than at any time in the 1920s. They have the most members of the U.S. House since 1928. They gained three governorships and now have a large majority of the governorships. And, of course, they took the U.S. Senate and now have a four-seat majority in the U.S. Senate, gaining nine seats. Those are historically impressive results, and it certainly produces a problem for Barack Obama in that it circumscribes his authority. He's got a Congress that's going to be eyeing him very carefully, and there won't be many areas where they can work comfortably together.
Mm-hmm. Can you say gridlock? Is that what we're looking at?
Well, potentially. You know, there are a few areas, corporate tax reform, some trade deals, where I think cooperation is possible. But the areas are very few. And a lot of things Obama put on his agenda after his reelection campaign simply have no chance in Congress mm-hmm. now.
This begs the question of vetoes. But of course, Barack Obama said he will. I think he's only used his veto pen twice on major
right.
legislation. So I think he's getting the pen out and blowing the dust off it. And that means that Republicans who control Congress, what does it take to override? Two-thirds in each chamber?
Two-thirds, and Republicans don't have two-thirds in either chamber.
Right.
So
the
president would be able to prevail with vetoes. And in an interview last week, the president said he may have to use his veto pen more often, and I'd be surprised if he didn't.
Right, right. Before we move out of Minnesota here, at least temporarily, looking at the congressional races this past election, all the incumbents won their reelection mm-hmm. contest. Of course, Michelle Bachmann in the 6th District chose not to run. We'll talk about her in a moment. But right from District number 1, Tim Walz, the 2nd District, Klein, 3rd,
mm-hmm.
Eric Paulson, mm-hmm. and right on through, except in the 8th District, a close call for Rick Nolan, the Democrat up there, very close.
Right, and that was one of the National Republican Party's top targets for the 2014 elections. And, you know, they recruited Stuart Mills of the Mills Fleet Farm family, who also self-funded, put in a lot of his own money, and made it into a very competitive race. But the key for Nolan's victory was the superior absentee ballot program of the Democratic Party. See, the state Democratic Party has more resources and operates more efficiently than does the state Republican Party organization. And was demonstrated in the absentee ballot program in the 8th District, where the number Nolan's lead in absentee ballots was greater than his lead when all votes were counted. So that made the difference.
Wow.
Right there.
Wow. That is amazing. There are some people who think that Stuart Mills, the Republican challenger, lost a lot of votes, maybe enough votes where had they gone the other way, he would have won had he cut his hair shorter, huh? Up in that now more conservative district.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of long-haired people up in the 8th. If you've, particularly if you go out in the smaller towns, barbers have a tough time there.
I've seen that. Before we move out of the 8th, we have to talk about the passing of Jim Oberstar, who for 36 years represented the sprawling 8th district of northeastern Minnesota, a district actually that touches the northern suburbs of the Twin Cities. This man, Oberstar, one of the last legislative giants in Minnesota here, at least for the time being?
Well, yeah, he on the Public Works and Transportation Committee, he was a major voice and helped to steer a lot of federal money up to the 8th District during those many, many years when he was part of the majority party in the U.S. House. And that's a legacy that will survive him for many years going forward.
I have a theory that I got to know him quite a bit over the years covering politics here in the state. And I think he was wounded deeply by his loss a couple of elections ago. I don't think he saw it coming.
No, hardly anybody did.
Right.
And that's the toughest loss to accept. That was in 2010, and Chip Kravac, who had never run for office before in the 8th District, was sort of a newcomer, did knock him off in a year when Republicans in the state did very well, with the conspicuous exception of the governor's race won by Mark Dayton.
Mm-hmm. I have a theory that, and who can prove it, but I think his Oberstar is so wounded that his death at 79 this year, I think in part was caused by his, maybe even depression over having lost politics and government. This is his whole life, and I'm sure he had to view his loss as a monumental blow against him, one of ingratitude for all the legislation, all the projects he brought to the state over the years.
Yeah, the management guru Peter Drucker, who wrote many books over the decades about effective conduct of organizations, made the point that retirement, I remember reading this memoir, mm-hmm. retirement is particularly difficult for people in public life because they tend to get consumed by their careers mm-hmm. and have nothing left once the career ends. And that can lead to depression and can lead to an early death, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk about Michelle Bachmann, who after four terms in Minnesota's 6th Congressional District decided to call it a career, at least in Congress for now. Stephen Scheer, this lady who often identified with the Tea Party and all the rest of it, give us a report card on her 8 years in Congress. What are her signal or main legislative accomplishments?
Well, I think she did get a bridge in the district, which is something she touts as one of her local accomplishments. She really did not accomplish much of any significance with legislation. She was much more, I think, a public spokesperson for her position, which continuously embroiled her in controversy, as we know. I noticed that during her last visit to the White House, she suggested to the president that he should bomb Iran. I thought, well, she's going out the way she came in.
Throwing bombs. Yeah. Well, what do you suppose, Stephen, what do you suppose is ahead for Michelle Bachmann?
Well, she claims that she'll return to politics, but it's not clear in what way. I mean, I could see her on talk radio or Fox television, perhaps. But I think her retirement was precipitated by her extremely narrow reelection victory in 2012 in a district that is heavily Republican. In other words, I think the voters suggested to her that retirement might be a favorable option for her, and she took their advice.
Mm-hmm. Yet Tom Emmer, who is, I think, politically of the same stripe, has won that seat, will go to Congress starting next week from the 6th District.
Right.
And so I think he's already hired more of Bachmann's staff members than new ones he's bringing on board, which is probably politically a smart thing to do. At least they know the ropes out there. They know where the restrooms are and all the rest of it out there.
Well, that's true, and it also helps him with the party in the district. But I would expect you will not see Emmer operating in as flamboyant a fashion as Bachmann did. After all, very few members of the House or Senate do. And So it'll be interesting to see, but I would expect a stylistic contrast.
Yeah, Hubert Humphrey learned that lesson the hard way, didn't he, way back
when?
Yes,
he did. He
came out a little too strong and got shot down for it, too. Stephen, before we take our first commercial break here, you mentioned that the Democrats are better funded, have more money, and that helped them in the 8th District. The Republicans are hurting for money, largely because their own people drove them into bankruptcy, right, a couple years
ago? Well, that's right. I mean, they have a legacy of extremely bad management by their former party chair, and they're still paying off debt. They also, you know, they've sort of narrowed their base ideologically by casting aspersions at more moderate Republicans like former Governor Arne Carlson, who doesn't even call himself a Republican anymore. So they've narrowed the tent, and they're out of money. Other than that, they're in great shape.
On that note, Stephen Scheer, our political government navigator here for looking back at 2014, and we're going to look ahead at 2015, both legislatively and both on the national and state level here. Stephen, stay with us. Folks, stay with us. We'll be back. We'll be back, Kyle, right after this.
At Hymie's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Hymie's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Hymie's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Hymie's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Hymie's.
We've been family owned since 1922, and we still believe that it all starts with you. We're the car dealer that leaves you feeling good. We treat you like every car dealer should. Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
This is DJ Redon's third generation owner, Stillwater Motors. On behalf of all of us at Stillwater Motors and from the many kids in need throughout the St. Croix Valley, we'd like to thank all of you for making our 2014 Christmas gift giving the best ever.
It's because of your generosity that children in need in your local area were able to wake up Christmas morning to new Christmas presents under their trees.
We're proud to partner with Family Means for such a worthwhile cause, and we look forward to helping our community again next year.
Thank you. Happy holidays from all of us at Stillwater Motors.
Stillwater Motors, good people to know.
You finally found it, that old photograph of your grandmother that you've always wanted to share with your grandchildren, but it's torn, cracked, and faded. Well, don't despair. Bring it in to Images of the Past in Stillwater. They specialize in restoring and preserving memories for future generations. So when you bring your old photos to Images of the Past, you can share that beautiful photograph with your grandchildren. You can see examples at klbbradio.com. Keyword, photo. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past. Political and government commentator and analyst par excellence, Stephen Scheer, professor of political science at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. With us on the phone right now, we're analyzing what has gone before and what's coming next to us here as we look at the Minnesota legislature about to kick off this coming week and the new session of Congress in Washington. Professor Scheer, let's look at the Minnesota landscape right now politically. We've got, as you mentioned, we've got DFL control, of course, in the governor's office. The voters re-upped Mark Dayton for another 4 years. The DFL holds on to the Senate. They were not up for re-election this time around. And the GOP, though, has the State House of Representatives, something of a triangulation. Just because the DFL holds the governor's office in the Senate doesn't mean they're going to be rubber stamps for each other. We know that from experience for sure. What are the main issues you see developing before the legislature, which starts Tuesday next at the state capitol?
Well, two that really do stand out are transportation and taxation. The governor apparently is going to propose an increase in the gas tax to pay for, more transportation infrastructure. Where and then there's also the question of where the transportation money is spent on metro projects, including mass transit, or on greater Minnesota roads and bridges. Republicans want more spent in greater Minnesota. They oppose the gas tax. Democrats will support the gas tax and want more spending in the metro area. So that's those two issues are going to be big battles.
It's always taxes, isn't it? I can hear the Republicans already saying, and we've heard this over the years, the especially the liberal arm of the Democratic Party, tax and spend, tax and spend.
Right,
so
right.
As Dayton comes forward with, he's also proposing a 0.5% sales tax increase in the metro area for mass transit projects, too.
Right, exactly, and that will be controversial as well. But an odd way to think about it, but probably accurate, is that in some ways the GOP may be more inclined to spend than the Democrats in this session. And here's what I mean by that. The Republicans will probably propose a series of tax cuts, given that we have a $1 billion surplus in the state budget, which is essentially a way of spending the money by reducing tax rates. Democrats want to probably save more of that and put it into the state's rainy day fund. So actually, the pro-spending party in the form of tax cuts may be the House Republicans, and there'll be a disagreement between the governor and the House Republicans over those issues as well.
Well, that'd be an interesting and unusual reversal of things at the Capitol normally, and that's very interesting. This is a budget-setting year, isn't it, Steve?
It is, so it's an extremely important one. And keep in mind, we have a $1 billion surplus, but the overall budget's going to be about $42 billion. So the majority leader of the state Senate, Tom Bach, said, you know, it's not that big a cushion.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, Stan, the state economy and the national economy are doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
We had the best national economic growth in the last quarter since the 1990s at 5%. The state has much lower unemployment than the nation as a whole, and the Twin Cities metro area has the lowest unemployment of any metropolitan area in the country. So all of that makes it a good time to be an incumbent.
It does. Look what I've done. Look what I've done for you, dear voters.
Yeah.
Okay, so taxes and spending, certainly front burner issues here in the coming session of the state legislature. Ah, but Steve Scheer, look what's rearing its head again. Repealing the ban on Sunday liquor sales. This time around, we might have a different outcome.
Yeah, we might. That actually it will probably get more attention from more citizens than everything that we've discussed so far in this program.
You know, I think I understand why, huh? With New Year's Eve still ringing in our heads. Well, repeat, Sunday, the ban on Sunday liquor sales goes back to 1935 in this state, right after Prohibition was taken off. And I noticed an interesting editorial in the Star Tribune the other day. It was a concession. The ban was a concession to what the editorial called the state's alcohol-abhorring, Sabbath-keeping Protestants, some of whom had been leaders in bringing Prohibition to the nation in 1919. Well,
let me just add on that. Most people are probably not aware that Minnesota was at the forefront of the Prohibition movement in 1919. The Volstead Act, which made liquor sales illegal in the country.
Mm-hmm.
That constitutional amendment was proposed by a Minnesota congressman named Volstead.
Andrew Volstead, right?
Yes.
To his everlasting fame and shame, depending on which side of the divide you're on. But this time around, Steve, repealing the Sunday liquor ban has some formidable advocates, not the least of whom is the Minnesota House Speaker-designate Kurt Daut, who will be leading the Republicans in the House. That's no small advantage, is it?
No, and actually, if there's one person to watch carefully over the next year in state government, it is the new Speaker of the House, Kurt Daut, because the relationship between Daut and his followers, the Republicans in the House, will determine how effective Daut is, how unified the Republicans are, and all that has a huge effect on what policies result, in state government.
Right. He's the gatekeeper, basically.
Yeah, so he's the guy to watch.
He's the second, the Speaker's about the second most powerful elected office in the state, isn't it, after the governor, basically.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, getting back to the efforts to repeal the Sunday liquor ban, Governor Dayton says that if a bill of that type reaches his desk, he will sign it. He will sign a bill that would remove the Sunday ban on liquor sales. In the House, Republicans are divided over ending that ban, but there are a couple of factions in the GOP coalition. Libertarians,
yes,
who want fewer limits on personal freedom, therefore lifting the ban, and free market advocates who want fewer government restrictions on commerce. So,
I don't
know what the head count is in the GOP caucus there in the State House, but this is going to be an interesting fight this time, isn't it?
Right, it is. But I think you can expect most Democrats in the State House and State Senate to vote for lifting the ban. So the real question is, how badly divided is Doubt's caucus in the House about this? Mm-hmm. And how does Doubt take the lead on this issue? Does he override the social conservatives who don't want to get rid of the ban, and does that create ill will when he comes back to them seeking party unity in the future? So it's an interesting leadership test for the new speaker.
Yep, it is indeed. 38 states, we should note for the record, 38 states now allow Sunday liquor sales. Mm-hmm. And so there we are. This is going to be, I think this could move close to the front burner, apart from the spending and tax issues in front of us. What else should we look for? I want to ask you about a project that's already underway. And this is the new State Senate office building, which became a lightning rod among politicians in the last election here. Republicans saying, this is an absolute white elephant. It's a waste of taxpayer money. We don't need the office building. Democrats say, yes, we do. We're out of space. We got to have it. Steve Scheer, cut through the fog. Who's right? Who's wrong on this one?
Well, first of all, it was a big issue in the state legislative races. It was one of the top issues used by Republican candidates throughout the state to try and indicate that the Democrats were a tax and spend party. And the eventual office building that will be erected is less ambitious than the Senate Majority Leader originally wanted, Tom Bach originally wanted. The short-term effect is that the Capitol's a mess right now. It's all torn up. All sorts of renovations are occurring in the Capitol building, as well as the creation of this new office building. To me, it's a fat target. You know, I can see why Republicans would raise this issue, and it probably worked for them in the elections and played an important role in getting a GOP majority in the state house.
Yeah, taking politics out of it, though, is the building needed?
I'm not an architect, so I can't really tell you that. I haven't done the space analysis or really heard the arguments in detail to be able to give you an opinion.
That's an artful cop-out. Thank you
well,
so much.
Well, I don't know. I'm skeptical, but okay. My skepticism isn't based on much evidence.
Okay. Well, that's okay with me. Your skepticism carries weight here on this end, I'll tell you that. I want to, before we move out of Minnesota and talk about the incoming Congress, we should note that Minnesota, let's see, those are the Independence Party here, has lost major party status because in the last election, 2014, they didn't get enough, their candidates didn't get enough of votes, did they?
Well, and it was close because the legal test was the party needed 5% of the vote in a statewide election, and their Secretary of State candidate got 4.9%.
Ooh.
So that, but that disqualifies them from state funding. Mm-hmm. The party has no money now. Mm-hmm. I think it will gradually, if not quickly, disappear. And one of the interesting questions is, where do those voters go? Because
right.
there are enough close races in areas of the state where the Independence Party voters can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And that will, so the demise of the Independence Party will affect both of the other major parties and the outcomes of elections.
Where do you think most of them will go, Steve?
Well, for many years, Democrats thought that the Independence Party voters came at their expense. Republicans in recent years have been making that argument. So I think you really have to go district by district, and I think you'll find in some districts it'll help Democrats, and in other districts it'll help Republicans.
Independence Party, isn't that the party that Jesse Ventura was going to build into a colossus here? Huh?
Right, long ago in a galaxy far away.
Yes, very much so. I don't think it happened. A lot of people, not necessarily admirers of Mr. Ventura, think that he was a party of one, that he represented the Jesse Ventura party.
Well, he represented it well.
Well said, my man. Well said. We're talking with political science professor and political and government analyst Steve Scheer from Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. You got to laugh at some of this stuff, folks. Let's take a look now at the incoming Congress. And as we do this, and this applies to state government, local government, any kind of government, compromise, Steve, can there be effective government at any level without a true spirit, without a true effort toward compromise on the issues? Giving a little, taking a little, finding common ground that will help all of us.
Right. Well, first of all, I think the president has to become a better bargainer. He's not very good at finding ways to make effective trades with people with whom he disagrees. So you have a problem on the president's end. As I was saying about the state house and Kurt Dowd, the key elements here are the relationship of the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with his caucus and the House Speaker John Boehner with his caucus, and how well they can bring along the more militant members of their caucus towards a compromise. At this point, I think that McConnell is better positioned to do that, in that there's not a sort of the number of real militants in the among Senate Republicans nationally is a pretty small group. It's mainly Mike Lee and Ted Cruz.
Are you talking Tea Party here, Steve?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Mitch McConnell has good relations with just about everybody except those two.
They tried to bump him off.
Right. Yeah. If you add it up, that's 52 votes. Mm-hmm. So he may be able to bring his own caucus along towards some deals with the president on issues I suggested earlier, like on trade and corporate taxes and so forth. The Speaker of the House has a tougher problem. Even though he has a large majority, 247, the largest majority for the GOP since 1928, he's got a significant group of militant conservatives who don't even want him as speaker. Right now they're conspiring to try and find an alternative to run against him for speaker. There are apparently about 16 to 18 of these fellows, but they can make a lot of noise and make a lot of difficulty in the caucus for John Boehner. And so Boehner, I think, faces more challenges within his caucus than McConnell. So we have to watch that and then see if the president ups his game in bargaining. So you see, when you put the probabilities together, Stan, it's hard to be optimistic.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying essentially that the Tea Party is a significant burr under the Republican saddle.
Hmm? Right, because, you know, if enough militant conservatives say no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So compromise, once again, circling back to the issue here, can there be effective government? Can there be progress in Congress and the legislature in city councils without it? And I don't think there can be.
Hmm? Yeah, but compromise has a bad name amongst political activists, you know.
Yes.
Democrats are pretty much a uniformly liberal party now. Hmm. And someone like Colin Peterson from the Western 7th District of Minnesota, who's a relatively conservative Democrat, is really a fish out of water in his own caucus.
He is.
And Republicans have become uniformly conservative. And so compromise is, first of all, very difficult because they're so far apart.
Well, they're polarized.
They're polarized. Yeah. And they are convinced they're right. And so it's compromise seems a moral failing to a lot of these representatives.
Compromise, the big C is a bad thing.
It's some sort of sin. And that means that not a lot happens.
Yeah, that's for sure. Steve, I don't know if you've had a chance to read. There are so many books out there on this subject, but one called Minnesota's Miracle by Tom Berg, a former DFL.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you read it?
I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
It's about compromise and how the legislature, the Republicans and Democrats, really did, hands across the aisle, they worked together back in the early 70s to remake Minnesota's tax structure. And really, I think most citizens of the state, certainly taxpayers, came out the better for it. It might be a wonderful example, an absolute glistening example of how compromise can work. It seems almost quaint by today's standards
that
something
like
that could happen.
Right. the parties have different constituent elements now. Back then, the state Republican Party had a large moderate wing, and there were even Republicans elected from the Twin Cities.
True. I knew a lot of them, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And an example of that wing was Arne Carlson,
yes,
who was the state auditor and then state governor. And Democrats had a group that was known in the 1990s as the Wood Ticks.
That's right.
And they were they were fiscally and socially conservative Democrats, uh-huh, from greater Minnesota. Well, the Wood Ticks have expired, as have the moderate Republicans. And so they're simply greater distance and low incentive to work across the aisle in both the state government and the national government.
Blue Dog Democrats and Wood Ticks, they're in short supply, I think, aren't
they? Yeah, they are. They are. Because, you see, a lot of those rural districts that elected Wood Ticks now elect Republicans, mm-hmm, and a lot of the districts that elected moderate Republicans in the metro area now elect Liberal Democrats.
Boy, folks, it's hard to keep track of this stuff, isn't it, huh? Wow, all these crazy titles and all the rest of it. And these are the people who govern us. Well, we'll be back with more with Professor Stephen Scheer with our political analysis of what's coming up. We'll focus on the coming session of Congress. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
David Garrett, the phenomenal maverick violinist who mixes rock, pop, and classical styles, will debut at the Historic State Theater in Music, A Gala Night with David Garrett. Music, A Gala Night with David Garrett on Wednesday, March 12th at 7:30 p.m. at the State Theater. Tickets at HennepinTheaterTrust.org.
At Hymie's Haberdashery, men never sacrifice fashion for weather. So no matter how cold it gets, you can still spot a Hymie's man by his impeccable taste and the confidence that only comes from a hot lather shave. Hymie's Haberdashery helps men look and feel their best with high-quality clothing cut and styled just for them. Create a look that's uniquely yours with tailored suits, overcoats, hats, and accessories that make winter blush and at prices that won't melt your wallet. Hymie's Haberdashery, 400 St. Peter Street in downtown St. Paul. Online at Hymie's.
They've been sitting on that shelf for years. Those special memories of your childhood on slides, videotapes, or 8mm film. You want to share them, but you don't have a way to do it. Well, now is the time to let Images of the Past do it for you, and you'll have those special memories to share during the holidays. Images of the Past can transfer your memories to DVD to be enjoyed anytime by the whole family. Think of the future, preserve the past. On Main Street in Stillwater at Images of the Past and at imagesofthepast.com.
Reed Hagen here, and I hope you'll join me this Monday morning at 10 on KLBB for a very special tribute to our friend Joyce Lamont. In a radio career that spanned 50 years, Joyce was a part of hundreds of thousands of listeners' lives with her daily special events, Best Buys, recipes, as well as her gentle humor, down-to-earth advice, and honest, friendly demeanor. You'll hear and relive much of that and more in Joyce's own words. KLBB remembers Joyce Lamont this Monday morning beginning at 10. I hope you can join us.
And we are back with our discussion of what lies ahead politically for us here as the new session of Congress convenes here in just a couple of days. And with us to help guide us through this is a professor of political science at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, Stephen Scheer. And Stephen, here we go. Lots of hot potatoes, political hot potatoes on the platter here in Congress for sure. Once again, just to review, Republicans will control both houses of Congress with Barack Obama in the White House. What are going to be the main points of friction here as we launch into the new Congress?
Well, let's talk about this month. Right. What happens immediately is that on February 28th, the Department of Homeland Security runs out of money.
That's not very reassuring, is it?
No. And so obviously some sort of bill has to be passed by the House and Senate and signed by the president. Now, the House and Senate Republican leaders are working to put together a package that will fund the Department of Homeland Security, but also include reforms to the nation's immigration laws, and including some sort of border security package that the president may find unacceptable, which could lead to a big battle with the president over keeping Homeland Security functioning.
My goodness.
So that's right on your front doorstep, Sam.
That's kind of a finger in our eye right out of the gate there, isn't it? You know, speaking of the Department of Homeland Security, they incorporated the Secret Service, didn't they, in them when they were formed?
Yes.
And
the
Secret Service has obviously, to commit an understatement, been fraught with major problems. Do you think a lot of it, they moved from Treasury Department to the Department of Homeland Security. Do you think this is part of the problem?
Well, I think so. The previous, the now resigned head of Secret Service had sort of reoriented the approach of the Secret Service to make it more citizen and community friendly, and de-emphasize its traditional security role. Well, we know how that worked out.
Yeah, like not at all.
Yeah, free entrance to the White House. Yes,
right, exactly. Just jump over that fence and you're inside, and you hope that the food is warm. And that's not meaning to make light of that. That's very serious.
Well, I've always been amazed that the White House hasn't been subject to more terrorist events. It's really quite vulnerable.
It is. I was in there just before I was called out with some local reporters from around the country, Steve, just before the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. And
oh,
I couldn't believe it. I carried a bag with some cameras and things, and nobody checked it. Nobody.
Yeah.
I walked
yeah.
right into the White House cloakroom. I walked downstairs looking for the restroom. I was wandering around in the White House, and nobody stopped me. Nobody was even around. It's laughable now, but it's not. I couldn't believe.
Well, but you're such a reputable-looking fellow.
No, I'm not.
They probably thought you were a cabinet officer.
Well, thank you. Definitely not reputable-looking, Steve. No. Let's get back to the Congress here. Immigration and Barack Obama's new tilt toward normalizing relations with Cuba. This raises interesting political questions for Republicans. They do need the Hispanic vote, don't they? And they've not been getting it. And if they take, quote-unquote, the wrong position on immigration reform and on Cuba, this could blow up on them, couldn't it?
Well, the Cuba issue is a generational issue amongst Cuban Americans. Younger Cuban Americans are in favor of an opening towards Cuba. Older Cuban Americans are not because of their memory of what happened during the revolution. So the Cuban American community itself is split on this. It used to be a real winner to be strong against Castro mm-hmm. with the Cuban American community, and Republicans could play that card effectively. Mm-hmm. That's less the case now. I saw a poll that showed that a majority of Cuban Americans thought it was time for diplomatic recognition of Cuba. Having said that, though, the Republicans in the House and Senate are not at all keen on supporting the president's initiative. The embargo, which is in congressional law, is unlikely to be changed by the Republican Congress. And the president's going to have trouble getting an ambassador confirmed in the Senate, because the chair of the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee that will consider an ambassador to Cuba is none other than Marco Rubio.
Whoa.
A Cuban-American from Florida, who is a strong opponent of diplomatic relations with Cuba. So you can imagine how that's going to play
Absolutely.
out.
Absolutely. What about immigration? The president's efforts to reform that and is certainly out four square against sending back to their native countries the sons and daughters of illegal aliens in this country.
Right. Well, that was all by executive order.
Right.
An executive order can be overturned by a president at any time. So whether this stays in law will really depend on who the next president is. Are we going to get immigration legislation and reform from Congress? No, I don't think so. Because as you can see, as I was just mentioning, Republican congressional leaders are attempting to attach to a Homeland Security funding bill some immigration legislation that the president will almost certainly oppose. So that just tells you that we're in for some headbutting over a considerable period of time about this.
And in the headbutting column as well, undoing or redoing Obamacare. What's the prognosis there?
Well, the House has voted over 25 times to abolish the Affordable Care Act. So clearly we know what their orientation is. The House Republicans want to abolish it. The question is whether what sort of legislation would move out of the Senate. But regardless of what comes out of the House or Senate, if the president doesn't like it, he'll veto it, and his veto will stick because the Republicans don't have the vote to override it. So there'll continue to be aggressive congressional oversight, a lot of controversy about the Affordable Care Act, but actually abolishing it in the next 2 years, very unlikely.
And, Steve, what about climate change? The president himself has taken action on several fronts, including a deal worked out in secret with China,
right,
trying to limit gas house emissions, that sort of thing. Climate change, a lot of people think there is not such a thing.
Yeah, I know. That's still a controversial issue that divides the two parties. The president will be taking a series of administrative actions through the Environmental Protection Agency, increased restrictions on coal plants, for example, coal-fired power plants, and that will produce a hostile reaction from House and Senate Republicans. There's just the gap between the president's agenda on climate change and the congressional Republican agenda is mammoth. And I think you can simply expect Congress to try and obstruct the president's actions on this as much as they can over the next 2 years.
So that kind of begs the questions, how lame a duck is this lame duck president, Steve?
Well, it looked bad the day after the election, but he has taken a number of executive actions since the election, you know, executive orders, presidential memoranda, a wide variety of areas such as immigration and climate change. These are actions that a president can take under the law, although Congress will be challenging certain actions he's already undertaken. But many of these can be taken under the law. But as executive orders, they are simply in force only as long as a president wants to maintain them. And so, as I said, his successor could get rid of a whole bunch of these. And that's usually what happens when party control of the presidency shifts. A whole bunch of these administrative actions and executive orders are overturned. So Obama will continue to try and do that. We should also note that the president's job approval rating has gone up since the election. It's now up in the Gallup poll to around 48%, which is the highest it's been in 13 months. And I think that's probably because we're in the midst of a sort of a mini economic renaissance. You know, the last quarter we had 5% growth. Oil prices are plummeting. You know, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan, which is an unpopular war. In the short term, this seems to be helping the president. And the more popular he is, the more political clout he will have in Washington. And so there's some grounds for Obama supporters to be optimistic about the future.
We are grateful to have the analysis on these subjects and more this noon hour from Professor Steve Scheer, a political science professor at Carleton College in Northfield. Gobs of money, more and more, millions, billions of dollars spent on political campaigns every year at all levels, Steve. This ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court a couple of years back, Citizens United, it's called, was that a bad ruling? Looking back on it, hasn't it opened the spigots? Has this opened the way for a gusher of campaign financing?
Yeah, I think the main problem with campaign finance is what we call the dark money. That is, there's a lot of money spent by political organizations that is not publicly disclosed, and we don't know who gets money from which sources, and Citizens United contributed to that problem. Full and immediate disclosure is essential, it seems to me. Now, you should also note that the omnibus spending bill that Congress passed in December that extended spending until next fall for almost all governmental functions, included in it a provision that increased the amount that individuals can contribute to political parties by a factor of about 10, from about $25,000 a year to over $200,000. So there was actually a reform that brings more money into the system. I don't know if you'd call it a reform, but the president signed that. So, but on the other hand, that's money that is publicly known and disclosed, which is better than the dark money, which is the main problem with the system.
the adage, follow the money, is not as too practicable when you have dark money out there.
No, the problem is you can't follow the money now.
No, you can't. See, yeah. Let's circle back to Minnesota right now. Politicians to watch right now. On the Democratic side of the ledger, I see three I'm keeping my eye on. Of course, U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. I'm talking about higher political office. Mm-hmm. Tim Walz, the 1st District Congressman, and Lori Swanson, the State Attorney General. I think they're all potential comers for sure. What do you think?
Right, and also the incoming lieutenant governor, who I am hearing is being groomed to run for governor to succeed Mark Dayton. So there are four right there. Walz apparently is interested in running for governor. Chris Coleman, mayor of St. Paul, is interested in running for governor. Lori Swanson may be part of that. I could go on. There's a long list of Democrats who I think R.T. Ryback wants to run for governor.
Sure, he does.
So you've got a whole bunch.
A whole bunch, yeah. How about on the Republican side?
Well, that's different. I think you have a thin bench there. I mean, it's pretty clear that Paulson and Klein and Emmer, who are, top-level Republican elected officials in the state as members of the U.S. House, none of them have interest in running, I think, for governor or for a statewide office. So then you get down into the ranks of state legislators who are relatively obscure at this point. And it's not at all clear to me who those comers are at
this
point.
That's right. What's your guess about Amy Klobuchar? What's in her political future? I don't
think she's going to challenge Hillary.
No.
Okay. I also don't think that Hillary, if she is the nominee, would pick a female for vice president.
Right.
She is moving up in the U.S. Senate. She's already now been elected to the Senate Democratic leadership, and she may move up in that Democratic leadership because she has good relationships with a wide variety of senators and good interpersonal skills. So my guess is that her additional, her moving up in the future will probably be within the U.S. Senate.
And the way I see Hillary Clinton, you mentioned her, I think she's a polarizing political figure. Either people really like her or really don't.
Yeah, but you have to say that if you look at all the Republicans who are considered as possible candidates to run against her, all of them are running behind her in the polls, and she's at 50% or above in the polls. So now, that's not to say that will persist, but at this point, she's in relatively strong shape.
Yeah, and there is a political group out there, actually a group here. Let's see, I can get the name for you in just a second. But looking down the pike 10 years, boy, that's a far-out view.
Yeah.
Minnesota could lose a seat in the U.S. House the next census 10 years
right.
down the road. That's amazing. That would not be good for the state, would it?
No, well, we came within a hair's breadth of losing a seat in 2010. We were one of the two state finalists for losing a seat. So the real question is whether our population growth keeps up with population growth elsewhere. It was a very close call in 2010. It'll be a very close call in 2020.
Yes, Polydata, I don't know if you know that organization,
yeah.
reports
mm-hmm.
that it appears Minnesota will lose one congressional member, retaining seven seats. If current projections hold true, Minnesota's losing population or not gaining it as fast as other states, as you say. So with that loss comes a loss of money and influence mm-hmm. in Congress, right?
Yeah, it does. And if you think about how it would be drawn, you'll see more districts drawn like the 7th and 8th districts, which are huge, in northern Minnesota.
Right.
But they extend into the greater metro area. The 7th includes St. Cloud, for example. The 8th includes Cambridge and areas around there. You'll get more and more districts that sort of take a part of the suburbs and then fan out into the vast reaches of greater Minnesota.
Right. Well, Stephen, sure, you and I have had many conversations, and you normally conclude them by saying, you've exhausted me. Have I done that again?
I am a spent force.
You're a wonderful force, too. Happy New Year. Thank you so much for your insights and your views, Stephen. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you. Stephen Scheer, professor of political science, Carleton College, Northfield. What a guy. What a mind. Wonderful chap. Has a sense of humor, too. We need that, don't we, these days? That's it. Stan Turner here. Thank you so much for your company. Have a great weekend. Stay warm, and good luck with that. We'll catch you noon on Monday for the All Request and Dedication program right here on Club 1220 KLBB.